why do so many people hate math?
What can math do for me? I was certainly that obnoxious teenager in high school geometry class that said, are we ever going to really use this in real life? Why do I need to know this? Because it just seems so irrelevant.
Math?
How am I supposed to know that? I'm a beautiful, popular, rich kid with a promising future in a lightweight sorority at a state college. I don't need to know that stuff.
You're taking 12th grade calculus?
Yeah, I like math.
Ew, why?
Because it's the same in every country.
It's beautiful. This girl is deep.
People don't like to be wrong. For many people whose exposure to math entirely consists of going to school, that's their total experience with math, so who would like that?
At my old school, if you got a high score in math, all you got was this.
A in math? I bet that A won't keep me from kicking your ass.
Maybe it's just Hollywood that hates math. On the other hand, you have to wonder, if Americans didn't have such a bad attitude about math, maybe we'd be better at it. Mathematician Jordan Ellenberg would like to do something about that. He's a number theorist, author of the book How Not to Be Wrong, and he believes math is for everyone.
Math is not a foreign language. It's our language. It's the language our minds naturally speak. Every piece of math, whether it's basic arithmetic or algebra or probability or calculus, it is built on the natural way that we think about things. I mean, made more formal, made more powerful, made more generalizable. But it's not something that like comes from space and we have to be trained to do instead of thinking. It's a way to improve our thinking and it's part of our thinking.
And yet people often seem not just to say, oh, I'm not good at math. They say, I hate math.
You know, I think that another way that math is taught differently is it's presented as something with really high stakes, like you're right or you're wrong. And to some extent, that is part of the nature of the subject. There are right answers and wrong answers, but people don't like to be wrong. And for many people whose exposure to math entirely consists of going to school, that's their total experience with math. So who would like that? I would like to see a situation where being wrong is somehow not so bad, where it's understood that in math, like anything else that's worth doing, making mistakes is part of the process.
Well, and there's something you do with your students, I think, with your calculus students, and you tend not to just say you're right or you're wrong. You grade partly on are they actually thinking about what they're doing or not.
Right, exactly. I mean, the example I use in the book is, you know, there's wrong and there's wrong. There's different ways to get a wrong answer. So if somebody is doing a calculus problem where the answer is supposed to be the amount of water left in a bucket at the end of a certain amount of time, you know, one of these kind of slightly artificial problems that we often ask our students to undertake as part of a calculus test. If they say at the end of the appointed time, there's -4 grams of water left in the bucket, that's an answer so wrong as to be in a certain sense offensive, right? Because of course there's not -4 grams of water left in the bucket. And if you write that, it's almost like you're saying, I'm rejecting the very idea that math has anything to do with the real world or that the things that you're asking me has any meaning besides these chicken scratches I've put on the page. No, math has meaning. Math is about things. And so I will give a student more credit, even if they've messed up the arithmetic somewhere. Okay, that could happen to anyone. But if they say, okay, I got -4, but I know that can't be right. That makes no sense. And I know that. I don't know what the answer is, but I know it's not that. That means the person is actually thinking. They're using the mathematics and their minds together as they should, and that's worth more than zero.
Can you give us an example of how math can help us understand daily life?
Daily life. Well, daily life is very different for different people, right? So one example I like is about thinking about politics and thinking about what we mean when we talk about public opinion. Often this can seem rather contradictory and weird. So a classical example is if you ask Americans, should the government be bigger or smaller? They will say smaller. Doesn't matter who you ask. Doesn't matter. Old, young, liberal town like Madison, conservative town like Waukesha. Doesn't matter. People will say the government should be smaller and it should spend less. Overall, it's like 70% say that. It's a huge majority. But if you dig down into that and you start to ask, okay, well, let's look at the different programs that the government funds. What about Medicare? Should we spend more or less on that? People say, well, that's good. People need health care. Okay, more on that. What about defense? Well, we have to stay safe. Like, we shouldn't spend less. We shouldn't cut there. What about the roads? Oh, I drive on the roads. That's important. That should be preserved too. And you go down the list of every major federal program, and every single one, people, the majority of people will say, well, don't cut that. That's
So they
important.
Want it smaller, but there's nothing they're willing to cut.
That's right. And it sounds like a paradox, right? And it sounds like the way that this is often written about is like, God, people are so stupid. Like, they don't grasp that if you want to cut spending, you have to cut spending on something. But when you think about this from a mathematical point of view, you arrive at a much more forgiving portrait of the American people.
How
what
so?
Seems like a contradiction is not a contradiction at all. Let's say everyone truly believes that spending should be cut. And let's say there's 10 programs we talk about. But let's say there's no consensus about which program should be cut. A tenth of people think it's Medicare. A tenth of people think it's the highways. A tenth of people think it's defense. Well, then for each program, 90% of people are going to say that's the one that shouldn't be cut. So it seems like evidence that the American people are somehow screwy or haven't thought through the consequences of their policy preferences. It really tells you that this notion of what is the popular will, like what does it mean for to have democracy? What does it mean for the government to obey what the people want is actually mathematically rather complicated. It's not as simple as you might at first think.
So how are we supposed to navigate in a world where statistics are being thrown at us right, left, and center constantly, and most of us don't know what to do with them?
Well, exactly, and it's a huge challenge. And I think one thing I want to push back on is I think that one way to deal with that is just to throw up your hands and say, oh, you can make statistics prove anything you want, so I'm just going to ignore statistics, and I'm going to ignore numbers, and I'm going to ignore quantities. I think, I mean, you know, what's the point of even living if that's your attitude? I mean, that's terrible. I think I don't think it's true that statistics can prove anything you want. But what I think is true is that we accord to numbers and quantities such an immense amount of prestige that in a sense, you know, somebody says a number and everybody else shuts up, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the end of the story. Like, well, there's the number. There's the answer. And it comes back to this thing that we teach mathematics as a subject which is about getting the answer to a question when we should be teaching it. I mean, that's part of it, but we should also be teaching it as asking the right questions, figuring out what the questions are and how to analyze things.
So what do you mean by that? I wanted to ask for a few examples. One that you give that's a wonderful story goes back to World War II and this guy named Abraham Wald.
Right. So this is the story, and this is the story that leads off the book. It takes place, as you said, during World War II. Abraham Wald is part of this top secret institute, which is in New York, where some of the best mathematicians and statisticians are working on secret work related to the war. It's called the Statistical Research Group. So this place is kind of like the Manhattan Project, except it's actually in Manhattan. And at one point, the generals come to the SRG, and here's the problem they ask. They say, we're noticing that the planes that are coming back from Germany, the bullet holes are not distributed equally across the whole plane. There's more bullet holes on the fuselage. There's less bullet holes on the engine. We can see that they're going to hit more on the fuselage. So we want to know, is there like a formula or something? How much more armor should we be putting where all the bullet holes are so we know how to make the planes as safe as possible? And what Wald told them is that they had it exactly wrong, that they needed to put more armor where the bullet holes were not, where the planes were getting hit less.
Why?
Why? Because it wasn't that the Germans were incapable of hitting the planes on the engine. It was that the planes that were getting hit on the engine were the ones that were not coming back from Germany.
But that's so brilliant.
It's mathematics, and it's not mathematics in the sense of a formula or a computation or algebra. Although I will say that, I mean, I've read Wald's actual paper on this, and in the actual paper, there's lots of algebra and computation and probability. But the fundamental idea doesn't have any of that. But nonetheless, it's extremely mathematical in that it says, okay, here's the question that you asked, which parts of the plane have more bullet holes on them? And they had the correct answer to that question. It's just a matter of counting. But was that the question you should have asked? And it was not. And that's where the mathematics really comes in.
Mm-hmm. That shape of thought that you just described, stepping back from the question to say, well, is that really the right question? And is there a different question or should it be framed differently? Do you feel like you do that all day long yourself?
Well, one thing, something that we do in mathematics a lot in our practice of pure mathematics when we're trying to prove a theorem is, you know, they say you should try to prove your theorem in the day and try to disprove it by night.
Hmm.
Sort of an old mathematical saying. It seems like a strange thing to do, to work across purposes to yourself. But the point is that, you know, you're working on something, trying to prove something. But one thing, until you've proved it, maybe that thing is not true. So you owe it to yourself to spend a little bit of time trying to prove the opposite. And I think that habit of mind is extremely healthy. You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald famously said that the test of a great mind is whether you can hold two opposed ideas in your mind at once. And mathematicians always have to do that. And I think that's, in general, It's a very mathematical skill, but it's one that applies more generally. The things that you believe, the things that make sense to you, the things that feel right to you, you should spend a certain portion of each day or a certain portion of each month or a certain portion of each year trying to put yourself in the frame of mind of believing the opposite of those things, to put pressure on your beliefs. That's, I think, how you get in the space of stepping back from something someone's telling you and saying, "Is maybe that's the right answer to the question they asked, but is it the right question?"
Jordan Ellenberg is a mathematician at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a number theorist, a columnist for Slate, and author of the new book, How Not to Be Wrong.